One night, after much thought, he tied a thread to the tip of his wife's hair and held the spool in his hand. When she left the bed, the thread on the spool began to unwind and started a wife path behind her. After a good interval had passed, the man followed the thread path. The thread went down the lane that crossed the fields and a cluster of huts. It went past the bazaar, past the temple, and followed the river. It stopped by a large peepal tree and climbed its bark. The man was puzzled. What could this mean? Why had the thread climbed the tree?
Hello and welcome to the South Asia Review of Books podcast from Himal South Asian, where we speak to celebrated authors and emerging literary voices from across South Asia. Today is Tuesday, the 19th of March. I'm your host, Shweta Srikanthan, assistant editor at Himal South Asian, coming to you from Colombo. And here with us today is Smriti Ravindra, joining us from Mumbai to talk about her debut novel, The Woman Who Climbed Trees, and the representation of the Madhesi community in the literary imagination of Nepal. The Nepali Indian writer Smriti Ravindra is a Fulbright scholar and holds an MFA in creative writing from the North Carolina State University. Her fiction and journalism have been published in the United States and in India, and she is the author of The Woman Who Climbed Trees, a searing story of three generations of women and the challenges faced by them in traditional societies across India and Nepal. The novel begins with the story of a woman who climbed trees every night, and she gets labeled as a witch by her community. This is a story of women who break rules and will keep climbing trees despite the constraints of society weighing them down. One of these women is the protagonist Meena, a girl who marries at a young age and moves from her home in India to Nepal. With the lyrical use of folklore and mythology, Smriti Ravindra unravels the experiences of women who leave their parents' homes after marriage and in the process become strangers to their own selves and outsiders in these settings. The story, set partly in the late 1980s and early 1990s of Kathmandu, also traces the major political transitions of Nepal, addressing questions of ethnicity and corruption, and in doing so, the book sheds light on the long-ignored topic of the Madhesi experience, particularly that of women in Nepali literature, which we'll explore further in today's conversation. Smriti, welcome to the South Asia Review of Books podcast, and thank you so much for joining us to talk about your excellent debut novel.
Thank you, Shweta. This is really a privilege and I'm very excited to be here.
So to start us off, you've mentioned that The Woman Who Climbed Trees began as a journal, and there's glimpses of stories from the novel in your column for the Kathmandu Post, for example. And one of my personal favorites, which I read recently, is the 2019 essay you wrote on your mother's search for Bollywood cinema upon moving to Kathmandu after marriage, and how it represents a connection to the language and culture she had left behind. And it also served as an escape for her from her life as a mother and wife. And this mirrors the book's protagonist, Meena's fixation on Bollywood in the kind of similar situation. So could you tell us a bit about how your personal experiences shaped this novel and what drew you to writing this story in particular?
So my personal experiences, a lot of it did shape the book. Like I said, it started off not so much as me wanting to write a novel, but me wanting to kind of hold on to my family and my mother's memories and stuff like that. So it started as a journal. I started it immediately after my mother passed. And I think it was my own way of holding on to a conversation with her. And I was afraid that I would lose her memory, that lose her entirely. So I think that fear drove me to trying to talk to her through a journal. And that's how it began. And a lot of my Kathmandu Post articles during that time, immediately after my mom's death and for a few years after that, were all about her. That was the only thing I could write about. I tried as I might, that's what I wrote about. I wrote about her presence in my life, her absence in my life, and how she had shaped my life. And so at one point I realized that I had written enough for it to be a novel. And so then I was like, maybe I should just write a novel. So it is very personal. That being said, it's also large chunks of it are intensely imagined. The first section of the book, for example, is entirely from Mina's point of view, and there is no way on earth could I have access to that information. Even if I were writing about a real human being, even if I were writing about my mother, for instance, that's the section that happens to a person who's much younger, so it would be beyond access to me. So there are huge chunks of the book that are imagined. It's also, the book is from multiple perspectives. So I've had to imagine all of those perspectives. So I feel that my personal desires and my personal experience with my mother has shaped my novel very strongly. But my personal experience with my nation has also shaped the book very strongly. And they say that the first book is always slightly autobiographical, and I am beginning to realize that maybe there is a huge truth to that. So that's what it is.
Thank you for that, Smriti. So you speak about nations, and that brings me to my next question. In Nepal, the issue of citizenship continues to be one of enormous political concern, and it's very much tied to debates on nationalism, patriarchy, and also the ethnocentric bias against Nepalese living in the southern region of Madhesh. So being Madhesi, especially for women, there were huge barriers to obtaining citizenship in the 1960s through to the 1990s. The years that the woman who climbed trees follows. So early in the novel, there's a beautiful scene where the barber's wife is applying wedding mehendi on Mina's palms, and she tells Mina that for men, the mother and the motherland are the hearts and livers of the body. They cannot be removed. Whereas for women, she says they are impermanent dreams. So the many generations of women in the novel are often recognized only as wives and not as immigrants, and they're never allowed to set root in any place. Could you tell us more about why and how you chose to highlight this aspect in the novel?
So I feel that immigration and the sense of being an immigrant is a central experience for many women. It doesn't even matter if you migrated from one nation to another, even if you have migrated from one home to another within your own neighborhood, you become an instant immigrant and you enter somebody else's house. And I think therefore women experience constant homelessness and or being an immigrant because you go into somebody else's nation, either literally somebody else's nation or figuratively somebody else's nation. When you shift from your own family, somebody else's family, into somebody else's rules and regulations, into somebody else's customs and traditions, with the expectation that you might bring with you traces of your own cultures and traces of your own fashion and traces of your own music, but you have to assimilate to the new one. And I think that's what immigration is all about. And you are never, no immigrant is ever allowed to go into the host country and say, I'm going to replace the whole host country's traditions and cultures with mine. Like that's when the entire universe saying, go back to your country and all of that starts happening. And when a woman tries that in a new, in her marital home, that happens to women too, where she has to, she suffers consequences of such a thing. And so women are constantly living the way migrants live everywhere, which is by adjusting and compromising and assimilating and changing identities and taking on the identity of the host family that she gets into. So while in my novel there is a literal migration that happens from one nation to another, I think very little would change even if it were within the same nation or within the same city. I know of many women in India and in Nepal. I mean, you know, I'm just saying India because right now I'm in India, but my own husband's mother, she is Tamilian and she was born and brought up in Tamil Nadu and then she moved to Maharashtra. She couldn't speak Marathi. She wasn't familiar with the Marathi culture and she lived her entire life feeling like an immigrant who couldn't even speak the language. So it doesn't matter whether it's a country. It can happen to you within your own nation. It can happen to you within your own city. And I think the system of marriage has been set up in such a way that it makes immediately and instantly an outsider of a woman. And before marriage, you're already told that your biological home is your temporary home and your permanent home is the home you marry into. So you even grow up thinking of your biological home slightly as not really yours fully. Our laws for the longest time that didn't have not allowed property to be transferred to the female's name. Our laws have told us that our homes are not our homes. right? So our nation tells us that the house you're born to is really not your house. You have no rights upon it because by law it doesn't come to you. Even now, if there's a son and a daughter and the head of the family who's a male happens to suddenly die, the property goes to the son. And so homelessness is, I think, very much in a part of the day-to-day living of a female's life. It is made so by culture. It is made so by law. It is made so by governments. It is made so by the internalized patriarchy that the woman herself lives through. And I think that's because just about everything that we live through right now is so, so driven by masculine patriarchal benefits. And it makes an outsider of a woman overnight through this very wonderful system called marriage and family. So I think that's essentially what I was trying to explore.
Thank you, Smriti. I think you've perfectly captured the kind of universal experience, right, of how women are made to feel like outsiders, despite the cultural and social similarities that there exists between countries across South Asia. So thank you for that. So my next question is that traditional folklore songs and mythology have always been an important part of storytelling across South Asia. In The Woman Who Climbed Trees, for example, we have Kathmandu and Janakpur being ancient cities that encompass myths connected to almost every historical element. These stories transcend borders and multiple generations. Could you tell us how this form of storytelling shapes the novel's narrative, particularly in exploring the role of women in traditional societies?
So first of all, I feel the Maithili women whom I'm writing about, culture of Mithila is very, very, it is often expressed through songs and through storytelling. So if you go to a Mithila marriage, from morning to noon to evening to night, there'll be a song that's playing. And the songs are always played by women. There'll be a whole bunch of old, corny women who will come out of their homes in the, you know, wee hours of the day, sit in the courtyard with a thola clenched between their thighs and start lustily beating upon it. And all the women will start singing the most hideous, off-key, tuneless, wonderful songs that you can imagine. Growing up, I used to be horribly embarrassed of this because my mother would also participate in this, and my grandmother would, and my entire female community would sit and start singing hideously. My family is not a very musical family. So they would all begin to start singing most hideously, the most hideous of songs. And I would be embarrassed beyond imagination, and I would always run away from them. But as I grew up, I think the one thing about marriage is that I started really enjoying, because it was so wonderful. Sometimes the entire neighborhood would come together. If you know, my uncle's son was getting married, and some 100 women must have come and sat in the corridor and really created a ruckus. The crows were beginning to sound sweeter than them, and it was marvelous to watch. And they were just so happy, and they were singing. The lyrics are always bawdy and lecherous and irreverent. And as I grew up, I began to also see these as spaces of resistance and spaces of joy. And they were all 80 years old and 60 years old and 40 years old. And they were all sitting together. And they were saying things about culture and about marriage and about men that they would not otherwise be allowed to say in their day-to-day living. It remains one of my favorite aspects of marriages in South Asia and of Madhis. When I was writing the book, I felt that if I was going to write about Madhesi women, I had to write about Madhesi songs, because that's where the Madhesi women are really having a good time. So that's where a lot of the songs come from. That's also where a lot of the folk stories come from. And if you write about Kathmandu, Kathmandu is just magic. Every street has a temple, and every temple has a bizarre story behind it. And if you are a person who doesn't, you know, need facts and who doesn't need historical accountability, then the whole city feels like a little space of magic, because they will tell you that, you know, Pashupati was born because a cow went there and gave her milk at a spot, and then they dug the thing and then Pashupati was born. And that's so much better than saying a king came and brought some bricks and laborers and slaves and forced them into building a temple. And so that these kind of stories are everywhere. Everything has a story behind it. So if you're writing about Kathmandu, then you have to write about its magical, mythical history, which is what I tried to do. So since I was writing about Kathmandu, I was writing about Madhesi women. I think songs are just became part of it. I didn't have to think much about it. It just became.
That was very interesting, and I love how you captured all this in the novel as well. Before we welcome you to read an excerpt from the book, I'd like to take a moment to invite our listeners to check out our website, himamag.com, for in-depth long-form independent coverage, including some of the most wide-ranging book reviews from around the region that rely on the support of our listeners. South Asia Review of Books is a podcast and a monthly newsletter that threads together our latest reviews and literary interviews. You'll find a special reading list curated by Smriti Ravindra in this month's edition, so do sign up for Himal's newsletters to keep up with our latest stories, podcasts, special events, and more. Now, Smriti, over to you to read an excerpt from The Woman Who Climbed Trees.
So I'm going to just read from the prologue, just because the prologue is short and succinct and can be read in one sitting. A man had two children, and one day his wife died. So the man went looking for another wife, but no woman would be burdened by the children, and the man remained unmarried for some years. Then one day the man went to a neighboring village for some work and heard of a family that had a girl of a marriageable age. After he had finished his work, the man went up to the family's house and made inquiries about the girl's age, color, and robustness. Satisfied, offered himself as a groom. He had wealth, he said, and lots of money left in him. He would take care of the girl, and the girl would take care of the children. "Show me the children," the girl said, and the man brought his children with him during his next visit. When the girl looked at the children, she fell in love with them. They were good children, shy and calm. They had beautiful, sad eyes like those of orphans, and they tugged at her heart, and so the girl married the man. For many years, the girl was mother to the sad-eyed children, and eventually their eyes began to glow with joy. They learned mischief, learned songs and dances, played in the fields. They learned to chase after cats and birds. Eventually, they forgot their birth mother and thought of the girl as their real mother. They grew up well, two handsome children. One night, the man could not sleep. It was a moon-filled night, and the rays fell silver upon his wife. The tree outside knocked at the window, quiet and musical. The man stayed up, enjoying the night, and when, around an hour after midnight, his wife pushed aside the covers and stepped off the bed, he was surprised. The girl put on her slippers. She made her way out the room and toward the front door. She stepped out of the house and disappeared. The man stayed behind, confused. The girl returned with the early hours. She did the same the next day, then the next, then the day after. The man was very disturbed by his wife's behavior and decided to follow her. One night, after much thought, he tied a thread to the tip of his wife's hair and held the spool in his hand. When she left the bed, the thread on the spool began to unwind and started a white path behind her. After a good interval had passed, the man followed the thread path. The thread went down the lane that crossed the fields and a cluster of huts. It went past the bazaar, past the temple, and followed the river. It stopped by a large peepal tree and climbed its bark. The man was puzzled. What could this mean? Why had the thread climbed the tree? He looked up, and sure enough, there was his wife, up on the tree, sitting on its branches, enjoying the wind and the stars. The man hid himself behind some bushes, and when he saw his wife readying to leave, he rushed back home. For a month after that, he followed her every night, and every night the girl climbed the tree and sat on its branches. Her feet dangled under her sari. Some nights she let down her hair, and her hair fell like a waterfall upon her back. The girl was beautiful, and the man was severely in love with her. But despite all this, he was also tormented. What could this mean? What could this mean? Finally, he began to talk about his wife with others. He told his friends, his sisters-in-law, his brothers. Word spread. "Ah," said the people, "she must be having an affair." But after many nights of watching the tree, it was clear there was no effect. She must be mad, said others. But all day the girl worked with such surety and skill that insanity had to be ruled out. Then someone said, she must be a witch. Think of it, said someone. We cannot understand anything she does. Why does she marry this man, someone so much older than her? Why does she choose not to have her own children and raise somebody else's? Why do these children love her so? Why does she look more beautiful at night than in the morning? Why does she sit high in a tree? Nobody could answer. The man thought hard about it and decided it was time to let the children know. She does not love you, he said. She is a witch. That is not true, cried the children. She loves us. She feeds us sweets, stitches our clothes, gives us baths, sends us to school, strokes our hair until we fall asleep, and sings in our sleep so we dream sweet. She loves us. Does she? Said the man. Come with me and I will show you. So he took the children along the next night and showed them the girl. She was upon the branches, light as a bird, her hair blowing in the wind, her skin without wrinkles. Now, said the man, is that a woman or is that a witch? The children stared. They had never seen their mother so lovely, so without worry, so far away, as though she cared nothing for them or for anything they knew. She is a witch, they said, and returned home with their father. The next night, the man, the children, the friends, the sisters-in-law, the brothers, the elders of the village surprised the wife by springing out of the bushes. When the wife fell off the branch, they gave her a good beating. The wife stared at her husband and said nothing. But when she saw her children, she began to weep. Save me! Save me! She cried. But the children, who had never seen their mother look so beautiful, could not step forward. They looked away and stared into the distance in fear. They pushed their fingers into their ears so they would not hear her scream. Then the villagers carried her to the river. The children stared into the distance. They kept their fingers in their ears and did not hear their mother crashing under the water, nor did they hear the silence when it came. The end.
Thank you, Smriti, for that reading. That scene actually leads me to my next question on how the novel follows three generations of women. Meena, the protagonist, her mother, Kaveri, her daughter, Preeti, among other women in the extended family and the village. And through these characters, you bring us stories of belonging, marriage, grief, desire, queerness, and so much more. For example, South Asian popular fiction, television, and films always portray tensions between mothers-in-law and daughters-in-law. They're usually pitted against each other and shown as hostile or evil. But in the novel, there's layers of complexity added to the same characters, where we see the circumstances that forces these women into these tropes. And as the book's title lets on, this is a story about women who keep climbing trees despite the constraints of society that are weighing them down. So could you tell us more about the significance of the title story and also how you've subverted the usual tropes of women characters found in popular South Asian literature?
Well, there are both the prologue and the epilogue are titled The Women Who Climb Trees. In the prologue, the woman who climbed trees is, as I just read, beaten to death because she's considered a witch. Whereas in the epilogue, the tree becomes a fantasy of escape and also a fantasy of a world that is matriarchal more than patriarchal. I think I really like how you put it, that it's not so much that mothers-in-laws and mother-in-laws and daughter-in-laws are enemies, it's that they are pitted against each other. It's that women are constantly fighting for resources that are denied to them. You know, it's only now, and even now, the fraction is not that large, but it's only now that women have, to some extent, become self-sufficient in monetarily. But until now, they fought for all kinds of resources. They've fought for money, they've fought for luxuries, they've fought for necessities. In many South Asian households, women are expected to eat after everybody else has eaten. So you fight for food. You fight for time of your husband because he really does not only belong to you, he belongs to everybody else, and in fact belongs to you least and most shamefully. And I think in Savari Devi's story, I explore how, you know, there are many traditions in which husbands and wives aren't supposed to be openly romantic. So their romance is then kind of secluded into a bedroom or in the dark or is clandestine. And so you're fighting for visibility, you're fighting for everything. And nobody can be generous when they're fighting all the time. In my novel, there are all kinds of women. There are mothers-in-law who are terrible, and there are mothers who are terrible. And it's a constant fight for resources. Even in real life, ultimately, it's only a woman who will sometimes understand what you're going through because they get your struggle, right? So in the book too, there are women who get each other. But also at the end of the day, it is sisterhood that comes to the rescue. A woman will get you. A woman will understand your desires and will get where your anger is coming from and where your frustration is coming from and will be able to talk to you about it. And I think that's what the epilogue is about. Yeah, there are too many women in the book. I don't know how to talk about them all.
Not at all. Thank you for that. Just to add to my earlier question, one of the striking elements of the book is the portrayal of imperfect women. They are flawed but deeply human. For example, in showing the realities of women's mental health in South Asian societies that often prioritize men's needs, especially in traditional systems of marriage. "She was not mad, though she longed for madness," reads one of the lines describing Mina, to show that what's labeled as madness is just a way of surviving in a patriarchal society. So could you tell us more about this aspect of the novel?
I've read often enough in various articles and news and, you know, research papers that South Asia has the largest number of mad women, apparently. We have the largest number of women who are depressed. We have women who suffer from mental health issues. And this, I'm assuming, just comes from the little tip of the iceberg that actually goes and talks to a doctor about this, because our women don't go to doctors. We sit at home and we believe in home cure, especially for the woman. Home cure is the remedy for everything. And we believe in this is how women are, and bucking it up and pulling it through. And just about every woman I have ever spoken to will tell me about one mad person in their family. I have yet to meet a woman who hasn't a mad person in their family. They might not recognize it as madness. They might recognize it as she is very annoying, or she's impossible to talk to, or she has OCD, or, you know, or she's depressed, or she never goes out, or she, you know, she's angry all the time. These are all mental health issues. And just nobody talking to you and nobody recognizing you, nobody recognizing your displacement. So much of your voice is lost when you go from one space to another. You know, there's a friend I have who always tells her, who told her daughter, and I thought it was one of the most beautiful things she said. She said to her daughter that you must have friends now because friends are your sakshidhar. So I asked her, what does that mean? I'm not very familiar with what that means. And she said, so they are people who know your story because they have seen you. They are your seers. They see you. And she said, because oftentimes when women go to another house, get married and go to another house, that house has many sakshidhar of the husband, because the father lives there, the mother lives there, the sisters, the, you know, the extended, whatever, the community belongs to the husband. So when the community comes together, they will all talk about, oh, remember when, you know, XYZ was little, this happened and that happened and this happened and that happened. And oftentimes the woman has no sakshidhar who can say, also when she was 10 and 11, this happened to her. And in the process of nobody telling you your story and you yourself being so much of a minority and often so shy about your own status in the house that you never tell your story, you forget your story. There is no witness to your story anymore. You yourself are not a witness to your story. So it dissolves. It just vanishes nowhere. And I think all of that leads to immense loneliness. It can lead to immense loneliness. And I think, at least in my book, I'm talking about a madness bred out of loneliness and voicelessness and not having anybody who can witness your story and tell you your story back to you.
I have a million more questions I could ask that came to me while reading the book, but it now brings me to our last question of the episode. The woman who climbed trees raises very important issues of borderlands and the ethnic question of Nepal. For example, the divide between the Paharis and the Madheshis. Meena's husband, Manmohan, and his family are seen as outsiders and more Indian than Nepali just for being Madheshis. This is one of the major achievements of the novel. It sheds light on the long-ignored topic of the Madhesi experience, particularly that of women. So what are some of the other gaps you identified and addressed when it comes to gender, class, and caste representations in Nepali society? And what are some books you would recommend that capture these aspects?
Recently, I read The Wayward Daughter by Shraddha Ghimire, and I thought it was just absolutely wonderful. And it really does talk about what is the difference between people who live in the capital city of Kathmandu versus those who live in the hills. And it's talking about very much, very similar to what the woman who climbed trees talks about, this hill versus the capital culture and the difference, and talks about migration too. And from a young girl's point of view. And I just thought it was a wonderful book. I really, really enjoyed it. The Land Where I Flee, while not a Nepali book in the sense that it didn't come from Nepal, it comes from Sikkim, very much talks about the India-Nepal connections that happen. In fact, most of Prajwal's book, that's the theme of it. It talks about that. I would recommend anything that Manushi Thapa writes. She is fabulous. Seasons of Flight is wonderful. Tilled Earth is wonderful. So yes, I think these would be some of the books from Nepal that I would recommend. And unfortunately, I don't know of books in fiction that talk about the Madhesi experience, especially the female Madhesi experience in Nepal. I haven't come across that book yet. That might just be my own ignorance, and or it might be that there are just no books, or books are so few in number. And I think that in itself, that the representation is so sparse and so scarce, tells us of the Madhesi experience. I think that in itself is a testimony to how that works and how undocumented it is and how sparse it is and how not spoken it is. I think growing up for me also, because nobody really talked about it all that much. People did talk about the political issues of Madhesis in Nepal, but they were all from male perspectives. They were talking about what men face. But what women face, I don't think was ever much for conversation. So growing up, it was hard for me to articulate also what women face. I think it took me some time. I had to mature into something to begin to even articulate some of that. And I think that's because that articulation does not exist all that much. I'm really hoping that changes. I'm really hoping that God gives me the stamina and the courage required to write a few more of this kind of book.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hope this book would serve as a starting point for many, many more books on the Madhesi experiences and that of women. So thank you for writing this.
Thank you for having me.
Priti, thank you again for that excellent discussion and for taking the time to speak with us today. It was an absolute pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you. I really had a good time talking to you.
Thank you for listening to the South Asia Review of Books podcast from Himal South Asian. This episode was edited by Ritika Chauhan. If you liked this episode, please share widely, rate, review, subscribe, and download the show on your favorite podcast apps. You can find Smriti Ravindra's reading list for the episode in this month's South Asia Review of Books newsletter. You can find the links to subscribe and listen to previous episodes on our website at himalmag.com. Thanks again, and until next time.